Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to this very special edition of Atlanta Business Radio, broadcasting live on the Business Radio X network. It is time for Atlanta Cares. Stone Payton, Grace Hayden with you. Grace is our host with our sponsor for the show, Atlanta Planning Group. Take it away, Miss Grace.
Thank you so much. I am so excited for today's episode. We've got a great lineup of guests, and kicking it off is Ms. Shilpa Jadwani. She's the owner and managing attorney at One Path Legal, with its head offices here in Alpharetta, Georgia. She's originally from New Jersey and graduated from Atlanta's John Marshall Law School in 2012. She holds the CALI for Excellence Award in Immigration Law, Attorney of the Year Georgia from Corporate America Magazine, Super Lawyers Rising Star Award, Top Attorneys of North America recipient, and Top Women Attorneys recipient, to name a few. In addition to her Juris Doctorate, Shilpa also has a bachelor's degree in psychology from Seton Hall University and a certificate in paralegal studies for Farley Dixon University. Ms. Jadwani specializes in all areas of immigration law, including employment-based classifications, family-based applications, and victim-based petitions. The firm also handles family law and business law matters. So Shilpa, thank you so much for joining us. And to get started, I'm curious, you clearly are very passionate about immigration law, but why did you choose it?
Thank you so much for having me. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here. It's a lot hearing that about myself. but it's actually very simple. It was just one of those things for me with immigration that clicked. Actually, when I started law school, I wanted to be a prosecutor. I had previously worked at a prosecutor's office in the Special Victims Unit handling sexual abuse and sexual violence cases. And so when I started law school, I was confident that that is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life until I took an immigration law class and things just clicked. You know, I'm an immigrant. I come from a family of immigrants. So we've been through pretty much the entire alphabet soup of visas, in the last 25, 30 years. And so when I was going through, the class and, you know, these things just made sense to me because I had gone through the process. And I realized that there was a lack, a significant lack of attorneys who would communicate with their clients, right? Really take the time out to explain to people what we as attorneys were doing for them, where their life was going, where their process was going. We would see a lot of people that said, here's my file, but I have no idea what's been done for me. I have no idea what my status is. I don't know what's been filed for me. And, I strongly fully believe that knowledge is power. So especially when it comes to your life and your legal matters, you need to know what's going on. And so I thought, well, why not me?
I think that's a great answer because I agree with you. Knowledge is power. And a lot of us in this room don't really understand how the immigration system works here. You know, we were born here and raised here. So how does it work here? What challenges do you get faced with and how does it affect your clients?
Well, there are a multitude of challenges. And of course, they come and change. Policies change, laws change with administrations, with who's in, you know, who the attorney general is, who the field office directors are, who the USCIS director is. And immigration falls under the Department of Homeland Security. So we hear a lot on TV, we hear on the radio, in newspapers about what's going on with immigration, but we don't actually know what's going on behind what they're reporting, right? A lot of the laws we hear right now, we're facing a situation with employment-based visas, especially H-1B is a hot topic right now, about hiring specialty workers, foreign workers, and them being displacing U.S. citizens for their jobs, right? This visa has been around for a very long time, and there are measurements in place by the Department of Labor to ensure that U.S. citizen workers are not displaced. But those are little things that you don't hear anybody talk about, right? You just hear media talk about foreigners are coming in and taking your jobs. And, you know, there is equal opportunity everywhere. And if you apply for it, you know, you have an equal shot just as everyone else. But what we're seeing right now is a high scrutiny, especially in IT positions, information technology field, where we see that they're challenging whether certain positions or specialty occupations. And the way that the government defines that is a position or a job that requires you to have a degree in order to do it or qualify to do that job. And we see a lot of positions like software developers are being questioned, right? Do you really need a degree to be a software developer? And we, as attorneys and, you know, representing our corporate clients, have to go into specificity and explain to these officers why somebody who's just right out of high school cannot, you know, develop an application or a software all by themselves at 18 years old. And then we run into challenges about, you know, the government being short-staffed and not being uniform across the board in how they implement their laws and their regulations. I'll just give you an example. We have companies that we have represented for years. A management company, for example, that only hires management analysts. And we had 6 approvals, the exact same position, almost identical qualifications for all of the candidates, because they only hire a specific set of people with a specific set of qualifications. And yet when those applications, 7 applications are assigned to 7 different officers, 5 of them approve and 2 of them deny, saying this is not a specialty position, which is ridiculous because the guy next to you just approved the other 5. Right. So these are the challenges that we're facing in the corporate world. With family-based immigration, we're seeing a lot of scrutiny in your past. Now, when you apply for a visa, the government is actually asking for all of your social media handles so they can look you up and see whether you are telling the truth about who you are and where you've been and what you've done and who you know, right? They're asking for your Facebook account, your LinkedIn account, your Instagram, your Twitter, your LinkedIn, your Snapchat. They want to know it all. And then, you know, these are what they claim to be national security measures to confirm identities and to confirm facts. But then because foreigners don't have the same rights as citizens, right? You either, if you want the visa, you have to give up your private information or, well, say bye-bye to USA.
Wow. Interesting. I never realized that whole aspect of it, that it's that invasive.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And then we haven't even started on the removal deportation work and, you know, how the immigration courts across the United States work and how arbitrary some judges can be in their adjudications. And, you know, I've had judges in Atlanta say, well, if you want to appeal it, if you don't feel my decision is right, that's fine. You can appeal it, you know, and it'll take the board 6 months to come back to you with a decision, and your client's going to be sitting in a detention center until then.
Wow. So you would say your job is probably equal parts knowing the law and knowing who you're dealing with.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, a big part of you need to know your audience, you know, with what we do. If you're filing a business like a work visa application, you need to know who your audience is. So you need to know what type of adjudicators and what type of officers are in these service centers and how to explain, walk them essentially through the process, because some of these adjudicators are right out of high school with 2 days training in DC, and then they're just let out into the field to decide, you know, the future of somebody's life.
Wow. So what would you say a typical work week for you is like? It sounds like you cover a lot of ground and have a lot of hats that you wear.
Oh, yes. You know, with in addition to being an attorney and a business owner, that comes with not just being an attorney all the time, because I do have to worry about admin and finances and running the business and staff, you know. So I do wear a lot of hats all the time. I'm also very involved with several nonprofits and in the community, because we do at One Path Legal feel very passionate about giving back. And like I said before, knowledge is power. So we like to go out there and make sure that everybody knows their rights, what they're dealing with. Even if you don't hire a lawyer, you should know the process and get the correct information. A big problem in the immigrant community that we see is when people come to me, and I hear this all the time, but I read on Google, or my friend's sister went through this process and they said they did it this way and they were fine. So why can't I do the same thing? And it's hard for them to understand that everyone's case is different. Everyone's facts are different, you know, and that changes the outcome. But no one, when we socially talk to each other as friends, we don't say, well, my case got denied because I didn't make enough money on my tax returns, right? Nobody ever says that. They just say, well, I went to this lawyer and my case got denied. Or I was dealing with immigration and my case was denied, or my husband was deported. And they'll never tell you the details, right? Nobody ever likes to talk about the what I did wrong.
So what are some questions that any client looking for an attorney should be asking their attorney?
What do I qualify for? What do I need documentation-wise? Where am I? What I recommend to a lot of my clients is doing something. Many people don't know this exists. It's called a Freedom of Information Act request, abbreviated as FOIA, a FOIA. And that is your entire record. So you can actually submit a FOIA application to the government to request that they provide you with a copy of everything that they have on you. That gives you an entire history of your life the way the government sees it.
It's kind of spooky.
It really is. But, you know, it you would be shocked as to how many people are surprised as to what they find in their own file. I didn't know that I ever applied for this, or I didn't know that this is what happened to that application. And they'll never know until we do the FOIA. I've had clients say, oh, I completely forgot I left the country during that time and, you know, reentered. You know, that happens all the time. Or I forgot about this misdemeanor from 30 years ago, which is likely, right? Think about in the grand scheme of things, selling alcohol to a minor on Sunday, or, you know, or selling alcohol on a Sunday before that was allowed or legal. And that was 30 years ago, right? Something that you just got a ticket for. Now, are you really going to remember that 30 years later? That's so insignificant in the grand scheme of things. So it's easy to forget these little matters, right? But then the government looks at you as if you're a criminal. You lied on your application. How could you not remember that you were arrested 30, 40 years ago for selling alcohol to a minor, or, you know, for selling alcohol on a Sunday, or not IDing someone?
So do you ever have things show up on the FOIA that weren't things that your clients have done?
All the time.
Can you contest it? What do you do in that situation?
Well, first of all, I would like to say to all the listeners, there's two people that you should never lie to, your doctor and your lawyer. You need to be extremely thorough and very, very forthcoming in those type of situations. Because if you don't tell these people who are trying to help you the entire truth, then they don't know how to help you. Right. At the 11th hour, if you're standing before a judge and the judge says, well, your client, you know, has a criminal record, or your client left the country and illegally reentered, and we don't know about it, then we don't know how to defend you if we don't know the facts. Right. If I know about this, then we come up with an appropriate strategy and something that you qualify for and how to rebut those allegations. But if this is the first time we're hearing about it, then it doesn't help you and it doesn't help me and it doesn't help your case. So it happens all the time, but the government makes mistakes as well. We did a FOIA once for a woman, and it took almost 3 weeks of sorting through all of the documents that the government gave us in that FOIA request to find out that they had mixed up three different people with the same first name and last name. And ironically enough, all three of them had the same date of birth. Oh, wow. But all three of them had different middle names, and that's how you could distinguish them. But they just looked at the first name, the last name, and the date of birth and thought it was the same person, and combined records for three different people and sent them to us. And we were trying to figure out, well, you said that you came on a visa, but this is showing something completely different, you know. And then we find a visa and we say, oh my gosh, but this is not the same person.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, in that case, we did affidavits and we pointed out to the government that, listen, you have a mix up in your records and you've mixed up three different people and think that they're one person. And aside from my client, you might want to fix this because there's two other people out there that don't have accurate records of their files.
Yeah, that are also affected. Absolutely. Wow. So that's a pretty great success story, that alone, to be able to find that and fix it and help two other people.
Yeah. Well, we hope that we help two other people, right?
Yeah, hopefully, hopefully they didn't just combine those two.
Yeah.
But so give us one other success story, your favorite win of your career.
Oh, my favorite win has to be early on in my career because it had a huge impact on me and the type of lawyer that I wanted to be. And this is when I was right out of law school and I joined One Path Legal, which was previously, Neera Ball and Associates. Neera Ball was my partner. She's now pursuing, the judiciary for a judge position. And I've recently bought the firm from her, but when I early on, started, I joined her in 2013 and we had a corporate client that came to us and said, we want to hire this immigrant and he's already on an H-1B visa. And, you know, we want to sponsor his green card. And he's been working with us for a year and a half now. And we said, well, that's great. You know, here's our checklist of documents and everything that we need from you to get started. And they called us and they said, well, what is this approval notice that you're asking for? Let me send you what we have. And this is a company that did not hire foreign workers often. So they weren't familiar with the process and they actually they didn't realize that there was a formal application process with the government to hire this man. And it's not like with U.S. citizens or green card holders where, you know, you just show that you are eligible to work or you're a U.S. citizen, you do your I-9, you know, verification and you're good to go. They never did any of that because they didn't know that there was a formal application process. They just hired him, put him on their payroll, and he'd been working with them for a year and a half. By the time they came to me. So when I looked at the paperwork and I said, guys, where's the approval notice from when you actually transferred his visa to your company? And they said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, there is a process and you have to get approval from the government in order to be able to hire this guy and have him work for you. And they had no idea. And it was a situation where this young man was supposed to leave 2 weeks later for the first time, was supposed to depart the country in about 4 or 5 years. He was supposed to go and get married. And of course, the fact is plain and simple that technically he violated his visa status and had been working without authorization for a year and a half. So the second he steps out of the country, he's barred from coming back because technically he's been out of status for a year and a half. So he can't come back for 10 years. And this poor man has to choose whether he's going to go back home and get married or he's going to stay here and figure this out as long as it takes, you know, to resolve the matter. And it was a very difficult situation. Luckily, there are laws and regulations in place for certain exigent situations like this. And we filed a non-protonc petition. And I remember getting an email approval from the government the night before he was supposed to leave. And I remember calling him at 11:30 at night as soon as I got the email. And I said, listen, I don't usually do this. I don't call my clients at 11:30 at night. And I don't mean to bother you. And I definitely don't call my clients at 11:30 at night from my cell phone. But this is a very special situation. But I do want to let you know that you're okay to get on the flight tomorrow and go and get married. We just got the approval and I'll mail it to you in India. You know, as soon as I get it in the mail, you can get your visa stamped and you can come back with you and your wife. And I remember this man cried for almost 15 minutes on the phone and said, I don't know what I would have done had we not met you and had you not picked up on this. I don't know where my life would be. I was seriously, my fiance and I were considering, do we push back the marriage? Do I just move back home? You know, what is my future? Because my life just got turned upside down in 2 weeks. And I wasn't here nor there. And I didn't know what to do. And you've just given me the best news of my life. And that feeling of being able to help someone and change their life had a huge impact on me. And it's a big part of why I am the way that I am as an attorney today and why I do what I do. You know, with all the stress of being a lawyer and a business person aside and all the tumultuous times in immigration, when you can touch one person's life and you can help one person, really, it's worth everything.
Wow. I have a new business idea for us, Stone. We're going to start a new show. It's going to be Law and Order, and instead of SVU, it's going to be Immigration Law. That was moving. I almost cried. Where are the tissues? Oh, my gosh. Well, if I was in need of an immigration attorney, I would hire you hands down. So for the listeners who might be in need, where can we find out more about you and your business and contact you?
Well, thank you so much for that. For anyone out there who does need immigration help or just wants to explore their options or just know the law as it pertains to them, you can find us on Facebook. You can look us up, One Path Legal. Our website is onepathlegal.com. And we are out in Alpharetta. You can also reach us via phone. Our office phone number is 770-622-1511.
Thank you so much. Will you stick around? We've got a couple more guests, and I think you'll really love to hear them.
Absolutely.
All right. Next up, we've got Nicole Feil. Nicole Feil is on the control room at CNN. She's actually the control room editor and is responsible for the last line of defense for CNN's on-air broadcasts. We actually tried to get her in here last month, but she was tied up with the impeachment trials and tribulations. So we're so lucky to have her in the studio today. She's also a four-time Peabody Award winner and an Emmy nominee and judge. She's got over 20 years of experience crafting CNN's breaking news and is a highly esteemed editorial trainer and mentor at the company's world headquarters. So by day, she is pretty much a big deal at CNN. By night, she actually has her own nonprofit called Softer Streets, which we have the pleasure of interviewing her today about. So tell us about Softer Streets. What do you guys do?
Well, Softer Streets actually was originally the idea of my co-founder and partner, Amy Laporte, who also was a CNN journalist at the time. And she would look out her window of her Atlanta apartment, which overlooked the Peachtree Pine area, and see homeless people sleeping on the streets on cardboard, newspapers, thin blankets, or nothing at all. And she said, this can't happen. So she started buying with her own money yoga mats and giving them out to people, at least getting them off the ground. And so it turned into this full-fledged idea, which is a whole long story. But what we do now is a very niche sort of harm reduction thing where we give insulated, water-resistant, portable sleeping mats to people who are unsheltered. And it keeps them off the ground. It keeps them dry. Bugs hate it. It's clean. It's warmer. And it can be life-saving. So that's what we do.
So why focus on having mats that are more protective as opposed to helping people get to shelters?
Exactly. Well, that's a multipartite answer. First of all, in some cases, there just aren't enough beds at shelters. We're seeing this in Atlanta now, where hypothermia deaths, the AJC just published an internal city report that found hypothermia deaths have tripled since the closure of the Peachtree Pine Center because people don't have a place to sleep. So that is part of it. Sometimes people choose not to sleep in shelters, and there are many reasons. I know people say, why would you ever sleep outside as opposed to in a shelter? And we've heard many different explanations for that, that there was a young man who was a veteran who had very bad PTSD, and he said, I have to sleep with my back against a wall. And in a shelter, you don't get to pick where you sleep. I would rather be under a bridge with my back against the concrete because that way at least I can sleep. We talked to a man who said, I stayed at the Peachtree Pine shelter back when it was open, and in the middle of the night, a rat dropped down and ran across my face. He said, at least out here, rats are going to run elsewhere and not across me. And it can be anything. Couples want to stay together. People don't want to give up pets. People have addiction issues. Sometimes some shelters, you can't even bring prescription medication with you without like a doctor's note. If you can't afford to go to a doctor and get the note and all you have is the prescription bottle, it's no good. People, unbelievably enough, there are people who work night shifts or even people who have two jobs and are homeless, and their shift keeps them from getting to the shelter before a curfew. Or they have to leave before everyone's up. There are so many reasons people can't or won't sleep in a shelter, and we just try to keep them alive and with all their fingers and toes and with a little bit of comfort and dignity and until they can get on their feet again.
And so what was it about the mats that made you zero in on mats? And yoga mats seem like a pretty good option. Was that not a more cost-efficient way, or?
Well, what happened was, and I'm so happy to say this, we originally started sourcing basically any cheap yoga mat that we could, and we were in contact with several of the camping supply distributors, and just trying to see what sort of deal we could get on bulk purchases. And Amy got a phone call from Climate, which is one of the premier camping outfitters in the country. And they said, you know, is this Amy? And she said, yes, who are you? And they said, we're the marketing department at Climate, and we heard that you're doing this thing. Can we help you? And she said, well, I don't know. What are you offering? And they said, you don't understand. We've been trying to do this for 2 years, and we haven't been able to find a partner because no one does this. We're the first nonprofit to do this. They said, we're in Utah. We've been trying to do this. We have a marketing plan ready to go out. We'll just give you the mats for cost, essentially. And so it wound up being far cheaper to get these fantastic, high quality mats instead of just foam mats, which, by the way, also collect water and dirt, and there is that issue with them. So
yeah, it's for sanity. And you actually brought in a sample of one of the mats, and I know the listeners can't see it, but maybe you could describe it, because I think there's a lot of benefits to the mat.
Yes. So unlike a traditional yoga mat, which we can all visualize, rolls up at, you know, maybe a couple of feet, 3 feet, something like that, and weighs, you know, sometimes up to 5 pounds. These mats roll up to maybe a little bit bigger than a thermos bottle or a big water bottle, and they weigh just over a pound. So this is something that you can fit in the bottom of your backpack. You can carry it in one hand. It is extremely small and light. And when you are unsheltered and you have to carry everything you own, that is the difference between having a mat and not having a mat many times.
And so is that why you guys picked the name Softer Streets, just because the mats make it softer? Is there kind of that element of making the streets a little less harsh and helping out?
There is that. And one thing I want to get across is people who've known me for a long time were surprised that I started any charity at all, let alone one like this, because the two things everyone knew about me in my previous life, which I go back a ways as an anti-human trafficking activist and worker, and my two big things were, number one, never start a charity. There's almost certainly already a charity doing whatever you want to do. Pair up with them. Why split resources? Why compete? Why not share overhead and administrative everything? Number two, if you're going to start a charity or even work at one, do something to interrupt the problem. Don't just put Band-Aids on things. And so when Amy first came to me and said, help me start a charity, the first thing I did was sit in my computer and try to prove her wrong, because I love her, but that's what I do as an editor. And I knew my friends in the nonprofit world and in the journalism world would be the first people to call us on it if it weren't a good idea. So the first thing I found out is, as I mentioned, nobody else was doing it. So we had to, if it's going to get done, we have to do it. And then I started realizing, we need a Band-Aid. Unfortunately, in this country, there are so many unsheltered people. There are over half a billion homeless people in America, and some percentage of them will be unsheltered at some point. We're making progress in some areas, losing progress in another. But the fact is, if you have a deep cut and you're bleeding out on a city sidewalk, you need a Band-Aid. Or all of the intervention, all of the future, you know, behavioral changes or whatever you want to help a person with to help ultimately get them off the streets, doesn't help if they're dead. And frankly, it doesn't help if they lose a finger or a toe, or they develop circulation issues that will plague them for the rest of their lives, or they get permanent neck and back and hip and knee injuries from sleeping on cold, hard concrete or wet ground. And so part of our job is just to keep people in a situation where, when these wonderful other nonprofits and partners and services find them, they're in a condition where they can be helped.
And you have to work under some constraints, right, with the law. I mean, homelessness seems like kind of a gray area anyways. You can't always sleep in certain places. You can have a mat, but can you have a tent? Or, you know, we see some, but what are some of the constraints that you have to work under?
That's a good point. And we are in 7 states already, and so we definitely have to keep in mind where we're working and how we can work. The beautiful thing about our mats is they're legal everywhere. And again, they're very portable. And so they're easy to take from one place to another. Because the fact of the matter is, a lot of communities, homeless people deal with, sort of being pushed out of certain areas from one place to another. So portability is really key. Tents are wonderful, you know, but the fact is it can get you ticketed, put in jail in some places and things like that. And then that's a life ruiner too. People are like, well, at least it's a warm place to sleep. Okay, but it's a very expensive warm place to sleep because then you have a criminal record. You have a ticket to pay that you can't pay, which turns into a warrant, which turns into this and that. And soon you are unable to find a job or a place to live because you're a criminal. And so we just avoid that whole thing by having something that is warmer and drier and off the ground without having a tent over it. I will say Climate, because they are wonderful and a very ethically driven company, they have really latched onto this idea of trying to help people have a shelter that's not quite a shelter. And so they're sort of working with their designers to potentially do a mat that has sort of a bivouac aspect to it, where you would sort of fold like a mini tent almost over your head part and head and shoulders. It will keep you warmer and drier, give a little privacy, and not qualify as a tent. And I hate that that's where we are as a people, but I do understand both sides of the issue. Where, you know, camping, sort of skid row areas are problematic. Again, we're just trying to help people stay alive and healthy long enough to get help.
And stay out of trouble.
Amen.
That's great. I love that you've been able to identify that area where there is a need, that it seems like a mat is kind of a small way to help, but it's actually huge. It's keeping people from getting ticketed. They don't have to go to the shelter if they don't want to or don't feel comfortable or there's no space. So I absolutely love that. But so you didn't have a background in nonprofits, right? You just jumped right in?
No, neither one of us had been on a board or anything like that. In fact, I laugh now because I had turned down several board offers. I don't have time. I don't have the money. I don't want to. I'm an introvert. I don't like to go accost people I don't know and beg for money and all of these things. And suddenly when I started doing research into this, before I was a co-founder and I was just supposed to be helping with paperwork to found a nonprofit, I start doing the research. I become blood-eyed obsessed about it. And like, this has to happen. And I turn into the Ancient Mariner. I'm grabbing everyone I know, like, listen to this story. And so that it sort of overtook our lives in this sense in the most organic way, where we became passionate about the issue. We knew we had something that was going to help a lot of people that no one else was doing. So we just had to teach ourselves how to do it and do it. And it's actually worked pretty well.
Talk about a learning curve.
It's the best kind of learning curve, because as journalists, we have to learn a lot about, or at least a little bit about everything. We can always have that debate about how much. But so we're used to learning things about things that are totally unfamiliar for us. But this was a thing where we got to deep dive and really gain new skills. So it's been very rewarding as well. But I think we've gotten in a good situation, and that's a blessing.
And so you're in multiple states now.
Yes.
How do you do that? Do you have a huge base of volunteers?
It's a lot of work.
Are you guys traveling constantly? And
no, one of the first things that Amy and I discussed when we sat down and realized this was going to be a partnership was we need to make this the type of nonprofit that can take care of itself to some degree. And so we very intentionally built it with very, very little overhead, with very few, well, actually no real staffing needs. Nobody gets paid. So we just do what we can when we can. The beauty of it is, our mats are not only portable individually, but you can ship a lot of them at a time. It doesn't cost a fortune. You don't need trucks or anything like that. And so I have largely done the vetting of the partners that we work with in different areas, and we make sure that our mats will be helpful to their clients and that they'll take care of them. And then we work on how we get them to their place. But we don't have to actually physically travel except for just the sort of startup parts of it. And then it's just a lot of paperwork and phone calls and emails and things like that.
Excellent. Well, if somebody wants to become a partner, someone in another state's listening and they feel passionate about their homeless community, how can they get involved?
So softerstreets.org is our website. Anybody can contact us through that. My email is Nicole, NICOLE, at softerstreets.org. You can find us on Facebook at Softer Streets. It's all very simple. And we love partners. We love donors. There's always more demand than there is supply. That's just the nature of probably nonprofit in general and definitely homeless nonprofit. So be sure to look us up. $14 really goes a long way.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time in this interview. We've got one more guest. I hope you'll stick around. All right. So next up, we've got Ms. Karen Kramer. She's the Vice President of Community Impact at TechBridge, which is a national nonprofit with a vision of poverty alleviation through collective data. Karen's passionate about data sharing and building data collaboratives across the broader nonprofit community that allow for the better coordination of services and the matching of service demand and capacity to improve community outcomes. Karen, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome to the studio.
Grace, thank you so much for having TechBridge on today.
Absolutely. So I love the name TechBridge. How is TechBridge kind of a bridge in the nonprofit community?
Well, I'd love to tell you a little bit about our history because in 2020, we're entering our 20th year of TechBridge.
Congratulations.
And the idea for TechBridge came from our two co-founders, Steve Lanoz and Scott Geller. And the idea came from the Silicon Valley Charitable Ball. And the Silicon Valley Charitable Ball would raise a lot of money for nonprofits to help them with capacity building. And so when Atlanta started becoming a big tech hub 20 years ago, the idea for TechBridge was founded. And our other co-founder said, you know, the technology community is really generous to nonprofits, but nonprofits really struggle with the implementation of technology and change management. Cy Fenton is one of our former board members, and he was the CIO of Books A Million, and now he's in at Ralph Lauren in New York. And he says, if you take really old processes and you add new technology, then you just have really expensive new technology. Mm. And so that's what we find with a lot of our nonprofits. So we started a consultancy focused on change management that knows nonprofits and knows technology. And we look at their data strategy. What impact are they trying to have in the community? What do they need to measure? What information do they need to share internally with their team? How do they share information externally with their stakeholders? And then looking at their processes, how do we automate this? How do we be more efficient with data? I used to work at a large nonprofit in Atlanta, was the data person, and literally swimming in spreadsheets. You know, the United Way report takes 2 weeks to do. And when we can make that with a click of a button and then introduce the most appropriate technology, that really transforms nonprofits. So we have two different strategies for revenue. We have a really generous technology community that supports us through our digital event series, culminating in our digital ball in May. And we have 900 attendees from the technology community come out and support the mission of TechBridge. And then we also have a consultancy and earned revenue helping nonprofits with consulting with data and technology.
I think that's a great initiative because once you can streamline those processes, that frees up a lot of time and resources for the nonprofit, which are pretty scarce to begin with.
Yeah, it frees up time and resources, and it can be such a paradigm shift. Like, you know, I'm a social worker by background, and we used to joke we majored in social work and all we did was paperwork. And then you free up people's time to spend more time with their clients one-on-one or to be able to serve more clients or to expand their mission to different schools or different counties or geographies. And so,
interesting. And so, what is TechBridge's vision for poverty alleviation?
So, TechBridge has been around for 20 years, and we've done a lot of transformations for thousands of nonprofits. But we were finding the nonprofits that were on the front lines of poverty invested the least in themselves when it came to technology. And it makes sense. If you have a client in front of you and they're homeless, they're about to be evicted, you're trying to get them shelter for that evening. And you don't worry about, do I have a CRM? Do I have a donor management system? Am I tracking my outcomes, improving my impact? You're focusing on the client's needs. So we felt like that was where we could make the most impact as TechBridge, is focusing on poverty alleviation. And we, our vision of collective action is trying to help every nonprofit to know from data what they do well, what they might not do as well, and who they need to partner with and focus on the community change that they're trying to achieve. And then we're trying to get all of them a client management system with an application programming interface so it's easier for them to share data with each other, with their funders, and with the community. Because at a community level, we talk a lot about population-level data, and we know the poverty rate in our community. But we don't know enough about what's working. And so TechBridge really sees us as the nonprofit pipeline of data to what's working, what combination of programs and services is leading to the best outcomes. If we have Miss Jones and her three children at the center of this ecosystem, can we see she went to these five nonprofits and she received these 10 programs and services, and that led to good outcomes? Maybe she went to a job training program that allowed her to get a living wage job, that then made housing affordable, that allowed her to move to a better neighborhood where her kids could go to good schools and improve their academic performance. And that's overcoming generational poverty. And then we also want to aggregate all of that data to see all of the Miss Jones, to see what are predictable pathways out of poverty and homelessness in our community. What combination of programs and services is the most effective? And use data to make those funding interventions in our community.
So you're kind of like the nonprofit pipeline of best practices. You share what's working, you collect it all in. You're like the Google
exactly.
of what's working. So what kind of capacity building help do nonprofits today need?
I always like to say they need the basics, the bread and butter. And so they need a donor management system so they can engage with their donors and manage their grant funds and when are applications due, when are reports due, so they can steward individual donors. They need a client management system so that they can track their clients and see what services they're receiving. And many nonprofits have lots of different programs, and they don't even know how many unduplicated clients that they're serving. Sometimes they need basics like getting to the cloud, email management, document storage, collaboration. Does your accounting system sync up with your donor management system? And so we just try and implement a simple system architecture to give them the basics so that they can spend more time on the community work and they're not so worried about their own infrastructure.
They let you guys handle the rest. All right. And so what about this Dream Big grant program you're working on?
Yeah, so we have a funding initiative due to the philanthropy of the technology community, and we will have applications available in February 2020, and we encourage Georgia nonprofits to apply for Dream Big. We raise money throughout the year and at our digital ball in May. And then in June, we have a panel of chief information officers who are often executive ambassadors for TechBridge. And they are our judging panel for the Dream Big Grant Awards. These are basic capacity building grants, move to the cloud, get a donor management system, get the reports that you need, get a data strategy. We'll give you a technology roadmap and strategy. And the judging panel is in June. And we had 50 nonprofits apply last year and 5 won. So it's very competitive, and there's not enough funds in our community for this basic capacity building that nonprofits need.
So what's that application process like? How do they apply for the grant? What do you guys look for?
So nonprofits always are skeptical of grant applications because they can be really long and complicated. Ours is really simple. You just ask a couple of questions and tell us what you need. You don't have to tell us what kind of technology you need. You just need to describe your problem really well, and then we'll solution to with you of what's the best strategy for you.
So what you guys are looking for is more how well you can address their issue, or is it based on the causes that they're working on that you feel more passionate about?
I think it's both. Is this a good fit for TechBridge and our skill set on our consulting team? And then the judges' heartstrings of what are the missions that they're really passionate about and would really like to get engaged. And we're really encouraging our corporate sponsors to get more involved with our nonprofits and bring technology-skilled volunteerism to our nonprofits that might not be able to afford TechBridge services, and to volunteer with their teams and use the skills they do every day on the job to benefit our nonprofits.
So is that kind of what inspired the technology career program you guys have?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we've always been a bridge from the technology community to nonprofits and bringing best practices to nonprofits. But we were really hearing from our corporate sponsors that we have all these jobs available, and we're having a really hard time finding community residents that have the skill sets to be able to meet job demand and industry demand. We thought, well, that's really interesting because we serve lots of nonprofits that are job training program providers and social support services. And where's the disconnect? And we found out that some of the job training programs weren't keeping up with what skills are relevant today, especially in IT, and what skills are going to be relevant in the future. And so we are really taking the leadership of the technology community to inform us on what do we need to train people on now. It's not hardware repair. Like, most of us are getting a new device on a yearly basis or every 2 years. So what are some future-proof jobs that we can train low-income residents? We train them over 4 months to get technology skills, and then they get a job placement with one of our sponsors.
Wow. And so for people who have corporations and are working on improving their development in the workforce, how can we improve those workforce development efforts here in Atlanta?
So I think there's a huge opportunity for us to be less siloed in workforce development. And so I think it's all of us working together. I really like the approach. There's a company called YouScience, and they do this interest and aptitude assessment for 12-year-olds to 90-year-olds. And they expose community residents to, here are a variety of jobs that you have the skills and the interest and aptitude that you'd be a good fit for. So think about the film industry, and everybody wants to be an actor, but what are all of the thousands of jobs that support that actor and making those available to our community residents? So our vision is that everybody could take an assessment like that, and then we would say, here are the job training programs that are available to you, but that they could be really relevant to what is high demand for our careers in our industry right now. And then I think on the employer side, we need to be more open to hiring people with non-traditional backgrounds and not put bachelor's degree required unless it really is, but do a better job of emphasizing the skills and the credentials that our workers need to be able to be successful in those jobs.
So do you have a story about a time you helped someone get placed at a dream job, or maybe they didn't realize they were good at a certain skill and you helped them find their path?
Yeah. So we featured a young woman at our digital ball last year, and she was a client of Raising Expectations, which is a youth development organization on the West Side. Her name is Lyric McGee. And Lyric was an outstanding student. She got a scholarship and was able to attend Agnes Scott. But then the money from the scholarship ran out, and so she wasn't able to finish at Agnes Scott. And so she went back to living with friends and couch surfing on the west side of Atlanta. She was introduced to our technology career program, went through the training in our first cohort for 4 months, got a job at NCR, now is able to have her own apartment, has gone back and finished her four-year degree. And that's a success story of just somebody that just needed a little bit more help and is just a shining star. And she got to share her story with 900 people, and there wasn't a dry eye in the room.
Wow, at the digital ball.
Yes, yes.
So I'm curious, this digital ball sounds fun. Tell me about that. How do I go? What do you guys do there? Do you wear gowns?
We wear gowns.
Really? Cool.
Last year, I wore my prom dress from 1995.
Wow. I mean, that's a feat in and of itself. I don't know if I could still fit in my prom dress.
Yeah, so that's the way the technology community comes together to support TechBridge. And so we're just thankful for our corporate sponsors that sponsor our digital event series and come together to support TechBridge and gathering of the community. And you get to hear about our technology career program and how we transform nonprofits. So okay. It would encourage lots of companies to get involved in our mission.
So you go and you guys talk about what you're doing as well as just have a good time and dress up and
a little
dance.
Of both.
A lot of fun.
That
sounds like a great time. So for any companies and organizations that want to get involved with you guys, how do they do that?
They can reach us at our website, www.techbridge.org, or our Twitter handle is at IamTechBridge.
Excellent. Just one more time. What was the Twitter handle?
I am TechBridge.
I am or I am?
I am.
I am TechBridge.
I am TechBridge.
Love it. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming today.
Thanks, Grace.
Again, this has been another fantastic episode of Atlanta Cares Radio.